my first identity is spiritual in nature. That's my primary identity. My secondary identity is my culture of origin. It's the fact that I'm male. It's the fact that I'm an artist. Those are all secondary identities. But the thing that I foreground when I enter a space is that primary identity first. And it's the thing that allows me to look at everybody and say, oh, there's my sister. Oh, that's my aunt over there. Oh, that's my mom. That's my dad over there. It's that interconnectedness that, you know, that is such an essential aspect, the foundational element of being a human being. That connects us all. So
yeah, that's beautiful. I like the way you phrase that your primary identity and your secondary identity.
Yeah.
You know, and that's consciousness that allows you to be a unifier and not a separator.
Nothing you do matters unless what you do matters. I'm Emadon Delerba, and this is Get Real or Die Trying.
Good afternoon, Emadon Delerba here with Get Real or Die Trying. I'm really excited to be here today on episode 23, sitting down, and I feel honored to have a conversation here with Masoud Olafani. And he is a gentleman that I have a lot of respect for. I've never met him, but just from reading his work, seeing his videos, seeing his art, I really was drawn to what his calling is and what he's doing in the world. He's a multidisciplinary artist. He's a writer. He's an actor. He's a host of the podcast America's Most Challenging Issue. He's the co-host of Retro Report on PBS, a primetime investigative news show that looks at news events through the lens of history. And he's a member of the Baha'i Faith, and he's a man of God. So very excited to sit down with Masoud. How you doing today, brother?
I'm doing pretty good, man. How you doing?
Really good. Thanks for coming on, man.
I'm happy to be here, brother. Happy to be here.
Well, we got a lot to talk about. I definitely want to dive into some spirituality and your Baha'i faith and how you interpret your view of life and things in the world through all that. But first, I wanted to talk about your art. For those of you who don't know who he is, check out his website. But a lot of very good pictures there of your different sculptures and different art forms. I find it very fascinating. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciated how you blended in a lot of cultural, important, historic facts into your art. Mm-hmm. So it was not just, it was kind of an educational lesson too, viewing the art. And I found it fascinating to be taught some of what you were trying to communicate, historical facts through art. So yeah, tell me about your art and how you see your art in the world.
Yeah. It's interesting, man. I mean, you know, I've been engaged in making visual objects ever since I was about 4 years old, you know, so a long time, just naturally drawn towards, you know, renderings and draftsmanship and, you know, cartoon characters initially, and then that developed over time. You know, I think the work that I'm making now, you know, which operates in multiple spaces creatively, like it's sculpture, but then it's also some drawn imagery, there's sound, there's video in some of the work as well. It's informed by a deep concern that I've always had regarding memory, historical truths, historical myths, historical lies, seeing how our past, our memory, our history impacts us today, the links between the then and the now, and also the possibility of what may be. So conceptually, those are issues that I've always kind of that I've kind of revolved around, you know, and always come back to consistently. I think those conceptual interests, I think, can be traced back to developing a deep love for reading, which happened when I was in high school. I was living in Queens, out in Far Rockaway near the beach, and I was actually going to school in Newark, New Jersey. So that train ride is usually between 60 minutes to an hour and 15 minutes long. So I just had a lot of time. So I started reading and fell in love with narrative stories, narrative structure, and was just naturally drawn to historical nonfiction books. And that's kind of where the love for those historical, mining the historic past as kind of like creative fodder began for me. So, yeah.
Very cool, man. Yeah, I appreciate that you know, some people, I guess, just do art for an emotional release, and it may not even have a meaning. It's just an abstract piece of art. It has a meaning to them, but it's not easily tangible to others. I think what I really liked about looking at your art is that it has a very clear meaning, you know, and it's and art to me should always communicate something, you know, it should communicate a message, it should uplift. And I think when we were talking on the phone a few weeks ago, I mentioned that I read the Urantia book. And, you know, there's a great quote I thought you would appreciate in the Urantia book about art. There's actually a few. I kind of think you're a poet too. You may not, from hearing you speak and hearing you write. And one of those is, only a poet can discern poetry in the commonplace prose of routine existence.
I love that.
I think some of your sculptures, I thought, like, wow, this is actually a tragic thing, or, you know, it's really a mundane thing of the existence, but you turned it into poetry and communicated that way. And then, of course, the art, this quote, "The high mission of any art is by its illusions to foreshadow a higher universe reality, to crystallize the emotions of time into the thought of eternity." So I thought you might appreciate that, just being a being an artist.
Definitely, man. Yeah, absolutely. There's a beautiful quote in the Bhairavis that says, "Art is a ladder for the soul."
Oh, very cool.
And I think so. It lifts us, you know. Hopefully, our intent as we utilize these gifts and these disciplines is really to elevate consciousness and thought and get us to a higher place. Which I think those two quotes that you shared definitely are in line with that kind of aspirational view of an artist who aspires to use their work in a deep and meaningful way. So yeah, man, that's awesome. Thank you, brother.
Yeah. For sharing that. Thank you. If there's one piece of art that you would consider your favorite that you've done and our listeners, you'd want them to check out, what would that be? Cause I know you name your art, you know?
Yeah. You know, the one that I'm thinking a lot of, probably because it's the most recent and it's a public work of art, is the Elder Project that I just completed.
Saw that.
Yeah. And that's important, I think, because of it foregrounds the history of a person that a lot of people don't know about, which was David T. Howard, who formerly had been an enslaved person. And after the Emancipation Proclamation and the end of the Civil War, he was able to develop an undertaking business here in Atlanta and acquired, a certain amount of monetary success, and then purchased some land where the original David T. Howard School was built. And that school, along with Booker T. Washington School here in Atlanta, were the only two schools that would educate Black students in the city. So, you know, it's a rich history that site, and all of the people who came through that school. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. went to that school as a boy. Maynard Jackson, the first African-American mayor of Atlanta, and other notable people. And so for that project, just because of that history, it was profound, but also because I got to work with alumni from the school and cast their hands, and their hands become a central element in the piece. And I was able actually to cast the hand of one of the original graduates of the original high school class, which is in 1946, I believe. And she's in her 90s now.
Wow.
So brought her into the studio. She held her hand very steady. We got a really good mold off her hand, and you know, now she's included in this piece to honor that history. So
that is cool.
Yeah. So a lot of that idea of memory and historical realities and legacy and the elders, you know, those who we unfortunately in our society too often discard, but they really are the repositories of memory and of history. And they're such an important and integral part of a healthy society. So
yeah, absolutely, man. I was attracted just to the name of it, and then I saw the hands coming out, and I was like, I had the thought, I wonder if those are specific people's hands, you know. It was really cool. And of course, the lack of in our culture respect for our elders today is really quite sad. And not just our chronological elders, but our spiritual elders, you know, the people that have gone before us, made the right choices, have a lot of wisdom to offer. And young people today don't seem to have the appreciation and respect, you know, that they did at one time. And as a young man, I myself, you know, I fail on that sometimes, but as a young man who's trying not to fail, I feel it's it's important for me to preach, so to speak, to other young people, to find their elders, respect their elders, learn from them. You know, I have spiritual teachers, I have spiritual elders, and sometimes your spiritual elders tell you things you don't want to hear, and that's part of the growth. You know, I'm sure we'll get into that more as a man of God yourself and in the Baha'i faith. But yeah, like I said, I really appreciate that your art communicates a higher message. You know, when you look at it, anyone who's got the eyes to see, they can tell that it's not really about you. And that's what I appreciate, you know. The art's not about you. It's about you're trying to communicate something bigger than yourself. You're trying to communicate historic facts and moving things that really place a lot of value and time on a whole culture, the African-American culture, too, a lot of what's gone on in the past. So thanks for that. I find it very educational.
I appreciate you on that, man. I appreciate, you know, it's interesting because I'm thinking about, you know, indigenous communities, man, and how the arts have a very, like, they're an integral part of those communities, right? Historically, whether you're talking about Native American indigenous tribes, or whether you're talking about African indigenous tribes, you know, tribes from Latin America, South America, what have you. And, you know, the art is really this fundamental, like, force within the totality of the culture. And even something as simple as a drinking vessel is treated with this incredible creative care, the way they designed it, the way it's executed, so that you're constantly surrounded by beauty. Mm. And that has meaning, right, in the way that we shape our lives. So, yeah, man, I think about that as I'm in my studio. I'm like, how can this work, this process, you know, which has these kind of majestic elements. How can it be in service to something that's greater than me? And that for me is really always the intent and the aspiration, man. So I appreciate you saying that. I'm trying, brother. I'm trying.
Thanks, man.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about how you became part of the Baha'i faith. You know, I think I read on your website it was during university it was introduced to you. And what were some of the things that attracted you to the Baha'i faith? What were the main tenets, or what really drew you in?
Yeah, you know, man, I grew up, man, with this really kind of like ecumenical kind of experience with religion. I mean, and it wasn't that my parents were intentionally trying to be ecumenical and you know, kind of expose me to a number of different faiths. It just happened by chance that my father at one point was very inspired and influenced by Malcolm X. So for a while I was in the Nation of Islam as a kid. I remember going to mosque. My grandmother was a Lutheran, so I used to go to Lutheran services. For a while we went to Southern Baptists. So I had this like really kind of varied kind of engagement with religion and spiritual expression within the context of religion. And then when I got to college, I really began to think critically about how religion manifested itself in practice, right? And how it, in ways that it lined up and in ways that it deviated in some fundamental ways from the teachings of the messenger or the manifestation of God of that particular faith, whether that be Jesus, Buddha, Krishna, Muhammad, so forth and so on. And one of the things that was really interesting to me, my experience with Christianity, was I couldn't understand why there were so many different churches that catered to a particular, they seemed to be very culturally exclusive. So you had a white church, you had a black church, you had an Asian church, you had a Latin church. And Christ's message to me seemed like it was one. It was about a kind of, inherent in it was a kind of a sense of unity in the sense that those teachings were for everybody. Everybody can find something meaningful in those teachings. So I didn't understand that division. And there were other things that were troubling to me. The kind of disharmony or the lack of harmony between science and religion, how there seemed to be a conscious decision within certain expressions of Christianity to kind of gut, right, the religious expression from to get science from that expression. So, you know, science was something to be viewed with skepticism or a kind of suspicion, you know, and that didn't make sense to me because I was like, well, if God created the world.
Yeah.
And I'm like, there seems to be an inherent harmony between everything within the world. I mean, all of the creatures, the water, the air, you know, the sky, all of these things seem to be working in a kind of symbiosis, a kind of harmony there. So it didn't make sense to me why science would be rejected. And then when I found the Baha'i faith, which I didn't go looking for, I was introduced to it. There was a young woman I was seeing when I was a student at Morehouse. And she was a theater student while I was in the art department. And she was the one, she was not a Baha'i, but she respected the Baha'i faith. And at the time, I thought I was going to be an Episcopalian priest. I mean, I had kind of, my career had kind of changed because I was going to an Episcopalian service, liked it, so forth and so on. And, but she's like, I don't think you're going to be a priest, Masood, but I think you might like the Baha'i faith. And she was the one that arranged the introduction to a woman who I now refer to as my spiritual mother, who's Jamila Kennedy, who's a longstanding Baha'i here in the community and just a community servant, just a wonderful servant. And that's how I began my engagement with the faith. Interesting, a postscript to this story is that the woman who I was dating, who I had asked to marry me, who had said yes, she contracted breast cancer and she died when she was 23, shortly after introducing me to the faith. Wow. So she had gone to New York University to start a graduate work and found out she had breast cancer and literally died within the year.
Wow.
So that's a profound kind of dimension of that story. Like she was on her way out, but prior to her leaving, she was like, I'm going to open this door for you, you know? And so I think about that quite often when I reflect on that story and, you know, what a key role that she played in me becoming a Baha'i. So, and the faith answered a lot of those questions for me, the oneness of mankind, which is the core principle of the faith. That's the main principle, harmony of science and religion, equality of women and men, spiritual solutions to social economic problems. So all of these things resonated for me and seemed to answer those questions that kept haunting me in my previous experiences with religion. And so, and that's how that journey began, man, for me. Yeah.
Wow. Very cool. Well, thanks for sharing. You know, I study a book called the Urantia Book, which is a revelation, and it's the fifth epical revelation. Mm-hmm. And I study continuing fifth epical revelation. Mm-hmm. These books called the Cosmic Family Volumes. Mm-hmm. And there's so many similarities between the Baha'i. Yeah. And, you know, I don't consider myself a part of any religion or a religionist, but I consider myself a religious man in the true context of what it means to be religious. But not in the dogma and the kind of the separations that you were talking about that we see in so many of the religions and the isms and the schisms.
Absolutely.
It creates a lot of separation, actually. And I'd like to, I've always been very attracted to the Baha'i faith and consider myself Baha'i in many ways as far as my agreement spiritually in my heart and soul with the tenets of it. And was blessed to visit the Baha'i Temple in Chicago and had a really beautiful experience there. And I've read lot of the teachings from the Baha'i faith. And so oftentimes, depending on what situation I'm in, someone will ask me, what's your spiritual beliefs? I'm like, well, you know, Baha'i is pretty much the closest thing. If you want to label me something, label me Baha'i, you know. But I read the Urantia Book, and I think there's truths in all religions, you know.
Absolutely.
And I think there's a lot of similarities in some of these tenets here. The you know, Baha'i talks about the unity of science and religion, and what I study is called ascension science, and that's the fusion of spirituality and science, and the importance that they're combined. And there's such a separation in other religions, as you mentioned. And we my parents actually founded a university called the University of Ascension Science and the Physics of Rebellion. And so that's a similar teaching there. And then, of course, the quality of the sexes, men and women, we have teachings about divine pattern and the balance of man and woman both being leadership roles and the mother spirit and the father spirit. And then, of course, one foundation for all religions. And we have a similar concept called unity, without uniformity. And that's what the Urantia book teaches. My father, Gabriel of Urantia, has a quote, one God, one planetary family. You know, that's it. You
I
know.
Love that. I love that. I yeah. love that.
So a lot of, a lot of similarities there, brother, that really, you know, connect. And one thing too is I was reading about the Universal House of Justice.
Yeah.
And of course we have the concept, also another parallel concept, divine administration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's an administration that has a, that governs the whole world that is divinely led. Mm-hmm. And it's divine because the human human people are in contact and hearing from God and listening to God. And there's a divine connection, you know, and that's really important.
Yeah.
And my mother actually also has been to the Baha'i Temple. She sent me, I told her I was going to be interviewing you, and she sent me this book here, World Peace and World Government. I've been kind of skipping through this. You know, that's a, I really appreciate how this was done, because in my own belief, personal beliefs, you know, I have these, I'm very convicted and committed to what I believe and passionate about it. Mm-hmm. And then there's a lot of, I do get into a lot of debates with people sometimes, and how to answer someone's questions. Well, how does that solve the problem can be difficult. And this is a really good, way that Tyson came up with the Baha'i approach to world peace and really the world government, which I also believe in, by the way, world government, divine administration is what we call it.
Yeah.
And there's a line in here that just stood out to me here. It says, some religious people will claim that the creation of a world government is insufficient to solve all of the problems of humanity because a world government cannot address the spiritual element of the problem. Baha'is would wholeheartedly agree with such a view. The spiritual development of mankind is the ultimate solution to problems induced by materialism. In the words of Baha'u'llah, the corrosion of ungodliness is eating into the vitals of human society. What else but the elixir of his potent revelation can cleanse and revive it? And so that to me sums it up, that it's about spiritual consciousness.
Absolutely.
You know, the spiritualution, it's basically the same thing as the Baha'i faith of oneness. It's the spiritual unity. It's the marriage of the word spiritual and revolution and spiritual and solution, a spiritualution.
And oh, so I love
that. Spiritualution is the solution.
Yeah.
And that was, that was, came up, my father created that in the early 90s, man. The spiritualution is it's a consciousness movement, man. So, that's what the Baha'i faith is talking about, man. It's all the same, man. It's about one love and
absolutely
having that consciousness together.
Yeah.
What do you, I think you, I mean, I know you do a lot of work with racism and educating around that. And you had that great talk, Erasing the Stain of Racism. And what do you think it's going to take for that spiritual consciousness on a mass level to rise? Because I have my opinions. I'm curious what you think. What is it going to take for really a global consciousness desire for unified spiritual consciousness?
You know, man, it's so interesting because, you know, we spent this quagmire of racism, which in America we've been at for some 401 years, right? Which was predicated on... well, it was developed in response to the challenge of reconciling behavior with Christian teachings, behavior that deviated from Christian teachings, and was tied very much to the economic engine, you know, here in America. So how do we get free labor to, you know, pick the cotton, you know, plant the cotton, cut the sugar cane, cut the tobacco leaf, and all of that? And then racism, of course, develops out of that as a way to justify the enslavement of a group of people, of our brothers and sisters who happen to be of African descent. So we've been at this predicament for a long time, for four centuries. And it's going to require a deep commitment. What the House of Justice says, there are two qualities that are indispensable to this work, which are patience and perseverance. And patience in the sense of being patient first with myself as I engage in this process, right? That I am, that I recognize that this is going to be work that is going to require me to tolerate discomfort, to actually consciously go into spaces that are uncomfortable. so I can engage in these conversations and what in the Baha'i Faith we call meaningful conversations, meaningful connections built one-on-one between people and individuals so that you can break down some of these divisions. So if I look at my circle of friends and I say, and I take a, from a practical point of view, I take a stock of my friendships and I say, man, all of my friends are African-American. Well, that can become kind of like an echo chamber, right? And it doesn't really, am I really doing my part in helping to break down these divisions by maintaining a circle of friends that is exclusively from my culture of origin? So I have to consciously on a day-to-day basis, question myself in regards to my circle of friends, look at what I'm, what am I doing on a day-to-day basis to help propel this idea, this concept, this spiritual law of the oneness of mankind forward. And so one thing I can do is to make sure that I'm building those relationships across culture, across social economic divides, across gender. So I'm extending that circle, that pool of humanity, right? And those, that connective tissue. So I'm essentially what I'm doing is playing catch up in a way to this spiritual law, right? I mean, the reality is that we're one, that you and I are brothers, right?
Absolutely.
So if I am, in some way, right, if I come from a situation or an environment that has told me that that's not the reality, well, I've got to get that stuff out of my system. I got to spend a lifetime purging myself of that poison because this reality is what it is. That's not changing, you know, so I have to play catch up. And then on a, so that's on the, on an individual level. So those are things that I'm interested in doing on an individual level. But then there is this kind of communal activity that the Baha'i community at large is engaged in, which is something that we call the core activities, or a plan of action, which is about spiritualizing our communities and our neighborhoods through activities and initiatives like children's classes, junior youth gatherings, devotional gatherings, junior youth empowerment workshops. And all of these are about really developing meaningful relationships and connections with people in your neighborhood, young people, as well as older people, people who are, you know, similar to you in age, and doing it around spiritual principles and laws, doing it around the word of God. It's not about converting anybody to Baha'i or trying to proselytize anybody about the Baha'i faith. It really is about, let's see what we can do as a community, right? These are some actions that we can take that are centered around the teachings of God that can help us deepen our relationships, that can help us develop stronger connection and have a healthier community for everybody. You know, no matter what your spiritual choice is, what you choose to do spiritually, whether you're Christian, Buddhist, Muslim, you're none of those things. But these are some cohesive ways that we can work to build a more unified community, extend that pool of humanity, of brotherhood and sisterhood, and heal this America of this conundrum, this sickness, this malignancy of race, which has perplexed us for 401 years. So,
Thanks, brother. Oh, it's long overdue, man. It's time for that stuff to be dropped. You know, I feel like we've gone, a little backwards the last 4 years, of course, but in some ways it's actually accelerated, the awareness and the need. It's kind of dug up some of that stuff that was buried, not really buried, but you know what I mean? Like, it's coming out in the country right now, and it's a cleansing process. It's the times that we live in. I was going to ask you about, you know, being Baha'i. Have you ever experienced like discrimination for being Baha'i? Because I know from my own personal standpoint, you know, I grew up in a community. And early on, we were called a cult, you know. And so that was the bias. And, you know, I was having a conversation with someone the other day, and I didn't want to be presumptuous and say that I, as a white man, could ever put myself in the shoes and say, I know what it's like to be a black African-American man and be black and feel racism and be called a nigger and all these things. But I could understand discrimination of that type of attitude for being, you know, you're part of a cult and this type of discrimination, religious discrimination and the feelings of that. And it kind of occurred to me like, wow, that's what it feels like. Imagine that, but even worse all the time. That's what racism feels like, you know? And And you can't hide the color of your skin. I can hide my religious belief. No one knows what I believe until I start speaking. Then the race, then the discrimination comes out. And so I had this profound experience of like, wow, you know, I'm putting myself in the shoes of another man, of another color, whether it's black, Asian, you know, any minority group, and how that, you know, because I think that white males, white people need to do that, to understand their white privilege. They need to understand, because we don't understand that we are privileged right off the bat. When I started kind of consciously diving into that, I experienced a heartfelt, like, wow, you know, that is what it's like, you know. I forget what I was going to ask you, but I was going
you were saying, have I ever experienced discrimination as a Baha'i?
So, obviously racial discrimination, but have you ever experienced religious discrimination?
Yeah, I mean, I would say skepticism, kind of looking, people looking at you kind of side-eyed. I've gotten some of that. People trying to prove to you that you're wrong and they're right. I'm fortunate. You know, as a Baha'i, because one of the core principles is independent investigation of truth. So we all have a responsibility to investigate the truth for ourselves and then determine where we land on that. So, you know, you can't be a Baha'i because your parents were a Baha'i. You can't be a Baha'i because, you know, you were born into a Baha'i family. That really is dependent on your own investigation of the writings of Baha'u'llah, and then you make a decision, you know? So, and that is to be encouraged. It's a spiritual law, and to be encouraged in everybody, you know, and the Baha'i, you know, beyond the, some of the mechanics of being a Baha'i, like an avowed believer in Baha'u'llah and his station and teachings of Baha'u'llah, at its core, the Baha'i faith means seeker of the truth or seeker of the light. So wherever you find that light and that truth and that reality, embrace it, you know? And this is why, you know, we have to be, this whole thing with, other religions, sometimes when they get into, well, it's our way or the highway, or if you don't believe this way, you're going to hell and all of this. And you know, I'm like, when Christians, some Christians say that about Muslims, I'm like, there's a billion Muslims in the world. They can't all be wrong. you know, there is something profound in the Quran that they found that speaks to their heart.
Yeah.
When I read the Quran, I find some beautiful writings in the Quran that speaks truth to me. I can go and I can read some of the quotes from indigenous communities, and they speak to me in the same way. You know, I can read some African proverbs. They speak to me in the same way. So that's the light of truth. Yeah. And I think the heart, as Khalil Gibran says, you know, no man can reveal to you aught of that which lies already half asleep in the dawning of your knowledge, you know. And he goes on to say, he talks about rhythm, and he talks about how the truth is like a rhythm that plucks the strings of the heart. And, you know, so, I mean, it's like, we know it's something that is beyond words, that can't be quantified in language, that can't be proven a scientific experiment in a lab. You know it when you come face to face with it.
Absolutely.
And that's what I always want to be open to and to continue to cultivate, is that awareness, that listening ear that is able to hear that rhythm and have my heart respond to the reality of that. So, you know, so I, in short, I've received certainly some side eyes, some suspicion, but you know, I'm fairly clear about where I am, and, you know, you just love people, man. People are where they are. And, if that's where they are and they have a hard time opening their eyes, and, you just have to love them through that, man.
Yeah,
you know?
Brother.
And, you know, that's all you can do.
Well, life is so much more pleasant when we just accept where other people are at. Absolutely. not that you're complacent or you allow evil, or, but not trying to force things, you know, and you love them through it. It takes a lot of stress. It's cool you mentioned Gibran, because he's a huge hero of mine in his work, and he's got that quote, your pain is the breaking of the shell that encompasses your understanding. You know, that's such a big one, that we have to realize that we get in our mental and our consciousness comfort zones, and it's painful to kind of break out of those. And you said a couple things in a speech that I've watched a few times because it was so good, erasing the stain of racism speech. And wanted to pull up something here. You said, kind of paraphrasing here, but you're talking about whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly.
Yeah.
And that really stood out to me because that's another parallel of something I believe from the Uranch book. And it says, throughout the universe, every unit is regarded as a part of the whole. Survival of the part is dependent on cooperation with the plan and purpose of the whole. The wholehearted desire and perfect willingness to do the Father's divine will.
I love that, man. I love that. Yeah, it's interesting because it reminds me of the whole idea of tossing a pebble into a pool of water. And those ripples extend from the center. And the entire pond at some point is impacted by those ripples. And so nothing that we do is in isolation, right? We're all interconnected. And so that is always something that, and that quote that I said in that in that talk comes from the poet John Donne, who Dr. King used to often quote. I just thought he phrased it so beautifully and so perfectly about our inherent interconnectedness and how, you know, we may attempt to block ourselves off, to close our borders, to build walls, but the reality is a virus can find its way through those walls.
Yeah.
You know, love can burst through those walls, you know. So there's no way really of closing ourselves off completely. We are interconnected. And
Brother.
So, you know, I love that, man. And it's the thing that the fact that, you know, that knowing that my identity, my first identity is spiritual in nature. That's my primary identity. My secondary identity is my culture of origin. It's the fact that I'm male. It's the fact that I'm an artist. Those are all secondary identities. But the thing that I foreground when I enter a space is that primary identity first. And it's the thing that allows me to look at everybody and say, oh, there's my sister. Oh, that's my aunt over there. Oh, that's my mom. That's my dad over there. It's that interconnectedness that, you know, that is such an essential aspect, the foundational element of being a human being, that connects us all. So
that's beautiful. I like the way you phrase that your primary identity and your secondary identity, you know, and that's consciousness that allows you to be a unifier and not a separator. And so many of us in this Western culture, but really all over the world, humanity, I think humans are raised, not even consciously, but raised the wrong way to be separators, to see the differences, not to see, you know, the similarities, what unifies us. Yeah. And it does take a spiritual God consciousness to see, oh, I am a spiritual being under a loving creator, and we're all created beings. Therefore, everybody's my brother and sister.
Exactly.
Everybody's my mother and my uncle. And it's such a refreshing and beautiful mindset.
Yeah.
And when you find others who share it, then you have cosmic family. You have a family, a spiritual family. That's another thing that we call our community is the cosmic family.
Because
even though the guy down the street may not be my blood brother, he's my brother, you know? And we actually treat ourselves like that spiritual family. And the same loyalty and the same commitment and the same family first type of attitude one would have with a biological blood family, you have with your spiritual brothers and sisters. And really, and it can extend across the whole world. And that's what the principle of Baha'i is talking about, world government. Because when each person has that consciousness in their heart and that God consciousness, then you don't see the walls. You don't see the separations. And it seems like a kind of a far-fetched, idealistic, dreamer type, you know, mentality for those who haven't experienced it. For brothers like you and I who have experienced it, it doesn't seem as far-fetched. Because if I can just take what I'm experiencing and help one other person experience, and then they experience it, and they're there, and that can spread.
Yeah.
And that's the consciousness of love, brother. You know, that's
exactly. I mean, division is the illusion.
Yeah.
Unity is the reality.
And
that is, when I think of my body and I think of how my body is composed, I have all of these cells, all of these organs that work together in unison to maintain this majestic, dynamic, extraordinary machine. So they have to work in unison.
Yeah.
So we think about the human family. The body politic is made up of individuals who operate like cells in the body. If we're in alignment, right, and we recognize that oneness, we will find ways to work together and recognize that what is good for my brother and my sister, right, fundamentally is also good for me. What is bad for me is also bad for my brother and sister.
Yep.
So in order for us to function collectively as a human family, we have to recognize that interdependence. Yeah.
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 Interdependence, mm-hmm. man. That's a key concept too. My spiritual teacher, Gabriel Virancho, he renamed Independence Day Interdependence Day.
I love that.
We would have these events on Independence Day. Yeah. Instead of being really nationalistic and flying the flag and being all about that, we would have interdependence, and we'd celebrate how each one of us human beings is interdependent upon our brothers and sisters all over the place, and celebrating that, you know, rejoicing in it. It's a beautiful thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I love that, brother. Love that.
You said a few things today, and also in some of your talks that I've seen online and some of the stuff I've read, that really speaks to me and my belief too, kind of about the duality of man and woman, and how we as spiritual beings are always trying to overcome our human nature and our spiritual nature. This is my wording, you know, and in your wording, you talked about, you have that talk, the Stonian glorious path towards oneness. Yeah. And I talked about, you know, the duality of man, and we're yearning to come into singularity, into unity, to rid ourselves of that duality of our animal, human nature battling our spiritual nature, until we come into singularity, and it's just spiritual nature. The reason why I like the stony and glorious path is because it is stony, and it's a hard path to get to that point.
Absolutely.
And it takes a lot of work. And as a man yourself, you know, I've been doing a lot of exploration of correcting wrong thinking as a male, you know, and even though I was raised right, I was totally raised right. Great father, great mother, spiritually God-centered, taught me right. Yeah. I still have absorbed the wrong thinking of the entire world. And so I have to correct the chauvinistic thinking, the machoism as a man. And I think, you know, in seeing you speak and reading your work, I find you to be a balanced, strong man, which I appreciate. And you have natural leadership qualities. Mm-hmm. And I think that when I view a lot of men today, there's a tremendous imbalance. They've become what I would consider personally weak, and not inheriting and personalizing the concept of what it means to be a strong man, or they're just macho and they're way too out of balance. What would you have to say to speaking towards young men and you know, how to become a balanced man? And what does it mean to you actually to be a spiritual God man?
Yeah, man, that's such a great question. I love the way you framed it. You know, it's interesting because, I mean, historically, you know, but if we look at the way that men have been socialized as opposed to how women have been socialized, you know, we have ascribed emotionalism, intuition, those qualities to women, while men are competitive, aggressive.
Yeah, stoic.
exactly, stoic, you know. And of course, we know the problems that have resulted from that. We have women who have been locked out of positions of leadership because they are deemed to be fundamentally incapable of occupying a boardroom or a prime minister's office or a president's office. You know, and then we have men who are, you know, deal with things like heart disease, high blood pressure, who are struggling to maintain this kind of stoicism that is fundamentally at odds with the emotional interiority of their lives. They reject their emotional interiority because we do have one, you know, men do have that. And then we're also not encouraged to develop our capacity to be intuitive as well, because I know many men who actually recognize that they have intuitive capabilities and actively work to develop those. So, you know, it really puts us at odds with this other dimension of ourselves. Women are not allowed to be ambitious in our society. You know, that is a quality that is almost, exclusively reserved for male energy, you know. And when a woman expresses her ambition, she is often called a lot of derogatory names, or referred to as being mean, or you know, what do you tell you? You're irresponsible. You're an irresponsible mother. What do you mean you're ambitious? You know. So I think as we, you know, the Baha'i Faith has this wonderful concept about man and woman are like the right and left wings of a bird. And in order for that bird to fly steady, both of those wings need to be strong.
Yeah.
So we have to find a way, men do, and I'm speaking because I'm a man, have to find a way to integrate those aspects which we have historically, society has taught us to reject. There's nothing unmanly about expressing your love for your children.
Yeah.
About hugging and kissing your children.
Definitely.
There's nothing unmanly in moments of great anguish or pain in crying out to God, pouring your heart, you know, on the altar of God and saying, I don't know what to do in this moment. Help me. Show me the way. You know, there's nothing unmanly about, you know, listening to your inner voice, recognizing that there's something operating beyond the intellect. You know, there's, as the old African proverb says, there's a difference between a knowing and a knowing, you know, so we have to begin to not see these things as mutually exclusive, but interdependent. And I think as we move forward and we mature as a human family, there will be less of that dichotomy. There will be less of that unintegrated, you know, that less of that tension, that kind of dissonance between the male energy and the female energy. And there will be more of an integration that will allow men to express their emotional interiority when the moment is right, when they're in a moment they need to express it, and will allow women to be ambitious without feeling that they will be labeled as being a bitch.
So. No, I appreciate that, man. Beautiful insight. Yeah, it really stood out to me. Again, watching your talk, and I was like, I like this guy because he's decisive, he's passionate, he's bold, and he's not afraid to, you know, be a man, basically, you know? And I do think that there's a bit of a fear now. It's gone the other end of the spectrum, actually, for men to exhibit what we culturally would consider manly qualities. The decisiveness, the passion, the absoluteness, you know, because there has been such an imbalance and most men have taken it too far. And, you know, and so I've been having conversations with different people on my podcast. I'm going to be on another show called Manly Matters. And just exploring this. But what's interesting is the men I've been talking to are my age, you know, 30. So I appreciate talking to a man like you who's been around longer. And who I considered it to appear balanced in your male circuitry as a man. So I appreciate that, brother. You know, and I appreciate,
brother, appreciate you. Man.
I appreciate your, you know, your insight there.
You know, the thing, dude, this is another aspect of it, man. There is a difference between men and women. We are different.
Totally.
But the difference is not, doesn't mean that one's better there. It's just different.
Yeah.
And we need both.
Yeah.
You know, we need
absolutely.
Both.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And do you find in the African American culture? I was having this conversation too with someone the other day. We were talking about, you know, I'm Italian American, my father's side Italian, and so obviously we're passionate. We show affection culturally, no problem. Men kiss each other, we hug each other, we love each other all the time. That's how I was raised.
Yeah.
In other, you know, cultures, it's very strange for a man to kiss another man or to say I love you. To tell another man, their best friend, love you, buddy. I love you, man. Which I find so strange because I tell my brothers I love them all the time. Man, I love you. I kiss them on the cheek if I have to, you know. It just shows what a cultural upbringing, how it really affects inherently how we behave as men. In the African and American culture, do you find that there's a more prevailing anger and machoism? Because of the trans generational trauma, really, to them and the oppression. And this is just I ask this question because I've kind of viewed it as that sometimes, that there's a deep inner anger. And then you see that, and then you see, it's interesting, and this is a touchy subject, so I could easily be misunderstood here by saying these things, but I'm taking the risk, you know. Some of my Native American brothers and sisters, my indigenous brothers and sisters, there's the same type of oppression, but they're not quite as in the machismo of anger. They're more in the hopelessness.
Yeah.
And they feel defeated as a man.
Yeah.
And so I've just observed these things culturally and historically. I'm not saying it's across the board. It's just something that I've been curious about and ask you if you've observed that or feel that way.
No, very much so. I think you've delineated quite effectively. I you know, it's interesting because when I've been spending a lot of time in Canada, and when I go to Canada, there aren't many African Americans in the part of Canada that I go to. But there are a lot of Indigenous Canadians or First Nation Canadians. And as soon as I meet them, there's an understanding, an unspoken understanding. It's an understanding that I know your struggle, you know, my struggle.
Yeah.
But the expression of that struggle is different, you know, across cultures. I think, in the African-American community, there's both cultures share a deep-seated mistrust of the dominant culture because their trust has been broken so many times.
Yep.
Agreements, promises have been broken. So over time, that gets solidified within your consciousness, and there's a sense of hopelessness or just an perpetual state of feeling like you're being surveilled.
Yeah.
And feeling like someone is watching you all the time.
Yeah.
And part of that, you know, part of that is based in reality, and part of it, it sometimes exists it's not in reality, you know, but it's based on some historical truths, and it's just in the muscle memory, so people respond that way, you know. And I think in the Indigenous community, because so much was taken from them, and they still live on land that they know was, or around land, or they remember the land, or you know, they can get around and they can see the land, so there's a sense of defeat, a sense of kind of, you know, our land was stolen, we were removed from our communities. Our hair was cut. We were not allowed to speak our language.
Yeah.
We were placed in these re-education schools. Alcohol was introduced to our community. And we were kept in a perpetual state of poverty, of impoverished conditions. So over time, that found damage to the psyche, which impacts how we think about ourselves, how they move through the world, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that sense of kind of defeat and kind of deep despair comes from that. African Americans is a little bit different because we were removed from the continent of Africa. We're not constantly assaulted by a visual image of what we had before or where we came from. Indeed, those realities were cut off systematically by the system of slavery. So your name was taken, your language was taken, all of that. But there's not the constant assault. There's not the visual assault of land, of the spaces that we came from. So that exists, but it exists in a kind of opaque, a kind of clouded, sometimes romantic vision that we have of where we came from, because we don't know the specific place. And also the brutality of the slavery system, which was so systematic. I mean, the emasculation of Black men, the fact that the owner of the plantation would come in and bed your wife and there's nothing you can do about it. The fact that you were beaten if you showed any resistance whatsoever. And even beyond that, sometimes strung up and killed or shot or some other kind of way you were offed. So that constant repression of the natural male inclination to defend your loved ones and indeed your sense of self, to have to constantly stamp that stuff and keep it repressed within you, allows that energy begins to boil over and it begins to be expressed when it can be expressed, sometimes in unhealthy ways.
Yeah.
So you will see in certain aspects of the Black community, you know, there will be physical violence within the home.
Yeah.
You will see high blood pressure. You'll see a lot of diabetes, a lot of heart disease, because there's this inability to historically grapple with those really profound emotions, angers, sadnesses that your family's experienced generationally, mm-hmm. and that they have not been allowed to process and express in a healthy way. And that gets passed down from generation to generation. So there's a lot of love in the Black community. There's a lot of compassion and affection. But it would be disingenuous of me to deny the fact that, yes, there is also those unhealthy, toxic forms of masculinity that also get expressed sometimes.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Wow. Well, thanks, man. Yeah. You have an incredibly well-rounded view of the spiritual, psychological, and historical aspects that affect everything of the current psyche today. And, you know, really well-rounded. I appreciate that. I think, you know, my mother, Neon Emerson Chase, who's a spiritual teacher as well, and she's a writer, she grew up on Native American Reservation, San Carlos Apache Reservation.
Yeah.
And so I spent time as well learning about the culture there and attending ceremonies there. Mm-hmm. And my father also has been very involved with Native American elders over time, and has done ceremonies and has met a lot of the well-known Native American elders.
Yeah.
And so I've been exposed to that culture, and I've been in these Anipis, the purification lodges, at a young age, and different ceremonies. And what I saw it's just hard to, it is what you said. It's the generational trauma, you know, and it's the father has the son and it gets passed down, and not even consciously. Yeah. But the sadness, the oppression, the anger, and then and also the righteous anger, the righteous sadness, you know, and trying to and trying to teach your children your heritage, your culture, and also not teach the rest. It's a very interesting thing. And I've had kind of roundtable discussions with young Native American men before who are quite impassioned and have their anger, rightfully so.
Yeah.
And honestly, I relate to them. You know, I feel one of them, and I feel one of the young Black brothers too. I feel like I'm one of them, even though I'm not. Yeah. So I don't want to be presumptuous to say I am because I haven't had those same experiences, but my heart connects with them. You know, I totally get it.
Yeah.
I'm a freedom fighter and I want to fight for them, you know? And so I look to the spiritual answers of these problems, and I look to what can I do to connect or to teach or to help or to even understand, maybe just be a good listener, maybe have compassion. Yeah. I think people think they're better listeners all the time than they actually are. I know I do. And then when when I actually listen and ask the question and really hear them, and the listening part and the hearing part is really penetrating my soul. And what is it that they're saying that I can find a similarity to, relate to, and have compassion for, or even change me, and even better yet, correct me if my thinking is wrong or aiding in their pain, you know? And so that's the responsibility that we all have to come into that spiritual unity and that oneness, you know, of humanity. We have to heal those constructs. You know, and I think that you have a great grasp on it, man. So I think you can do a lot of great work. I think you should help. I think you are helping, but I see you as you could be a great mentor for young men in your community and really talking them through that and being a role model. And you are a role model, and you probably already are doing it through your art, and you are doing it, but I could just see you, like, you know, really leading the way for that healing to take place. Wow. So I appreciate it, man.
Thank you, brother. The encouragement is such a important apparatus for community building that we don't access enough, and we need to be constantly encouraging each other in our work. So, man, for you to say that, I'm honored, and it encourages me to keep pushing, brother, just to keep pushing. Yeah, yeah.
And another question I had for you, you know, we talked about the Baha'i and the oneness of humanity. What are your thoughts on the amalgamation of all the races? You know, I was reading about you and that you have Irish in you.
Yeah.
And What are your thoughts about the intermixing of, you know, because I've always thought one way, this is obviously a long-term thing, but one way to heal this is to intermarry all the time. And there's part of a culture that's the consciousness that's wrong, where I have friends who are Jewish, you got to marry a Jewish person no matter what, you know, African-American friends, you got to marry that, Native American, and keep the culture. And part of me can understand that pride of wanting to extend your genes of your race, you know. And, as an Italian, sometimes I'm like, oh, it'd be nice to marry an Italian woman and keep the Italian genes going, you know.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Overcoming that consciousness and how we're raised to really amalgamate.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, first of all, it's not practical. There aren't enough people available in all of those brackets to constantly find a partner that's going to match up. So there's just a practical problem with that, you know, on the surface. But yeah, absolutely, man. I think one of the most profound ways to affect change just symbolically is to marry across culture. Yeah. Now, again, I'm not saying I want to be clear. I've seen some extraordinary marriages between people from the same culture.
Of course. Yeah.
They're committed, they're spiritually deepened, they're connected, and they have valuable lessons to teach all of us about partnership. So I don't want to diminish those relationships, but certainly one of the most profound ways to make a statement to the world about the issue of race, the illusion of racism, the fact that it's only a social construct, that's not a biological reality, is by intermarrying, you know, by choosing to marry someone who's outside of your cultural origin. Yeah. And also, you know, I mean, the children are really, if they're integrated, if they understand that they're, that within them exist these two streams, these two pools of humanity, that they can be a powerful example of what's possible when different worlds, different experiences come together. Yeah. So, you know, I'm blessed. A woman that I'm close to is from another culture, and I feel so enriched by that relationship.
Yeah.
The fact that she questions me, right, in ways that I previously probably wouldn't have been questioned. I mean, she helps me to think about things in a broader way. And I think I do the same thing for her. And I think, as you know, as long as we foreground that spiritual reality as being our primary identity, and then we also have a deep and abiding sense that it is our diversity that adds to the richness and the beautiful complexity of the human family, right? That God didn't choose to make us all one shape. Yeah. And there's a reason for that. He wanted a diversity of visual expressions, you know, in his through creativity. And there's something about being able to see that diversity and then to understand that all of that is part of the human family, and the that palette, that color palette, which extends all the way from blue, black, all the way to treble white, you know, is beautiful. All of those colors in between is beautiful and adds to the richness. So I think it's a wonderful, wonderful opportunity to extend that sense of community, to tear down those walls that separate us, and to build, you know, a diverse and inclusive society. So I think it's a wonderful thing, brother. I really do. Cool. I didn't always think that, man. If I'm being transparent, I did not. I was one who consciously dated black women exclusively, who thought I would always marry a black woman. And there was some of that, what you were talking about was in me.
Yeah.
That, you know, I got to keep it. Keep this strong for the brothers and the sisters. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, totally.
I mean, you know, I gotta marry a strong black woman.
Yeah.
But what I began to realize was that phenotype, culture of origin, are limited constructs for something that is limitless, which is love.
Yeah.
So if is based on a limited construct, then I'm not being consistent with the power, the transcendence, the divinity of love.
Absolutely.
So,
that's on point, man. I like that.
Yeah, yeah, brother.
That is on point.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. What do you think, not what do you think, but does the Baha'i faith have any teachings about what I call the end times, the purification times that I personally think we're in on this planet right now? A lot of religions talk about, you know, the rapture, the end of times, so to speak. Yeah. Hopi prophecy gets into it a lot, and the signs that will dictate that. A lot of religions talk about the return of their Messiah, whatever that Messiah may be in their various religions. To me, it's more of a general understanding that the times that we're in right now is I think we're in those tribulation times, and it's
absolutely
happening.
Absolutely. You know, the Baha'i theology in regards to this issue of an afterlife and end times, it's interesting because, you know, religious truth, religious narratives, particular biblical narratives, Quranic narratives, Hindu narratives, Buddhist narratives, they're written in the language of metaphor and allegory. Mm-hmm. So they're stories that have a deeper meaning and that are symbolic, right? So in Revelations, some of the fantastical stories of Revelations, using our intellect, which is a gift from God, by the way, you know, a lot of people have issue with that, but it is, you know, and logic, one knows that those verbatim, the way those stories are told verbatimly, if that's the way you took them, they don't make logical sense. So if that's the case, what is the deeper spiritual meaning here? What's the lesson that I'm meant to take from this narrative? Mm-hmm. When Christ says, it is easier for a rich man to enter the, what is it?
It's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle.
Yeah, than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven.
Yeah.
That's a metaphor. There's an allegory there. Mm-hmm. There's a deeper spiritual meaning, mm-hmm. you know, that's hidden, you know, that's operating beneath that, you know, that very visual image, right?
Yeah.
So these deeper meanings are couched in these fantastical tales, which are told to grip us, to captivate the mind and the spirit. And then upon meditation and reflection, we get the deeper meaning, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in Baha'i theology, Baha'u'llah says that this idea of an afterlife is really, he makes it very practical. And what he says was, regard, you know, humanity comes from God, creation comes from God. So our ultimate sense of heaven or paradise is in our relationship to God, in our closeness to God.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're getting back to your source of creation.
Yeah.
Now, if we have led a life that is meaningful, if we have led a life of service, if we have tried to make the world a better place because of our presence on this planet. If we have been faithful in our relationships, if we have done work that is meaningful, that helps to extend, you know, humanity's awareness and understanding of their place in the world, that we enter this next phase of our existence, which is beyond the human body, right? Where that limited, that corpus, that flesh structure of cells, we no longer need it. The soul wants to be free so it can fly. You know, and when we enter that realm of existence beyond the physical, we are prepared, just as a child is prepared when they enter the world and they have all of their functioning limbs, they're able to see, they can hear, they're prepared for the world, the physical reality. If we've lived a good life, when we exit the physical reality, we're prepared for the spiritual reality. On the other hand, if we have not led a productive life, if we have consciously chosen to do things that would hurt people, if we have been disloyal in our friendships, if we have engaged in work that is destructive and not constructive, then we enter that next phase of existence, which is spiritual, deeply handicapped,
mm-hmm.
and separated from the source of our creation, mm-hmm. hell, which is hell. Because you want to get back to the source. And if you're kept from the source, that's a stasis of hell.
Yeah.
So it's that, for me, I found that aspect of the Baha'i teaching deeply satisfying for me because it took it out of the fantastical mm-hmm. and made it very practical and seemed very logical to me, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So, Yeah, I like what you said about, you know, hell is any time that we're out of the will of our Father, absolutely, our Creator. That's absolutely hell. I mean, it's not some burning place we're going, no, you know, at the end of our life here in the human form. Yeah. Hell is moment to moment. We can choose to be in hell.
Absolutely. You know,
I could walk out of this interview and be in hell because my consciousness took me there.
Absolutely, brother.
Anytime I deny the love of my Creator and the responsibility to recognize that and act in it and then share that, I'm in hell.
Absolutely.
That's what I feel.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, man, you're also an actor, which is pretty cool. I'm an actor. I'd love to be doing more acting. I've been doing some auditions. I was doing auditions before the global pandemic hit over in New Mexico, which is like the closest, you know. But you're in Atlanta, where they shoot a lot of movies, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Ton. It's like the Hollywood of the East.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So tell me about how you got into acting. I guess you did some theater when you were younger and.
Yeah, you know, man, that story, man, is really interesting because it really was it was like an intersection of like opportunity and like just risk taking.
Yeah,
because I didn't, you know, when I was in grade school, I did a few school plays, nothing serious. Princess and the Frog. I did a production of Raisin in the Sun when I was in school. But certainly there was nobody in my immediate surroundings who was a professional actor. I had no context around me to know what that journey looked like or what you were even supposed to do.
Yeah.
But when I was in grad school, I did a little bit of modeling in grad school, nothing serious. And then I answered an ad in the newspaper for a play called The Meeting, which is about a fictitious meeting between Malcolm X and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., written by a very talented playwright named Jeff Stetson. And I got cast as Malcolm X.
Yeah.
The play goes on and it got really good reviews and I was able to get an agent and then started doing some auditions. And that's how it built.
Cool.
And then I got into television hosting because I did a play here in Atlanta called 4 Days of Fury, the Atlanta Race Riots in 1906. Unbeknownst to me in the audience that night for one of the presentations, one of the plays, one of the performances was the president of Georgia Public Broadcasting. She liked what I did in the play, and she invited me to work on a production that they were putting together. And from there, I got an audition for Retro Report, and that's how I got on Retro Report. And so this thing just, you know, you know, there's a mystical thing the whole time I'm going through this process, brother. I'm like, I know I'm doing my part, but there's something operating here, which I don't fully understand, but I know it's operating.
Yeah.
So I just got to kind of let this thing go and just see where it kind of takes me. So, and that's how it's going, man.
That's cool.
That's how it's going.
Well, yeah. It sounds like you made right choices along the way, that it was manifested in the spiritual realm for you, you know. I think sometimes we can try too hard to make something happen. We get ourselves in the way. It seems like you you know, it's a destiny calling for you, and you have the persona, you have the self-confidence that you kind of just fell into place. I'd like to see that. I'd like to see that play, man. Is it recorded?
No, unfortunately, it's not.
Yeah.
Yeah, we didn't record it, but it was so much fun doing Malcolm X. Man, it was awesome. It was awesome.
Yeah, I recall seeing one of your art pieces that was the name of it was a play on something King said and something Malcolm X said. What was it?
Yeah, the ballad or the bullet.
Yeah, the ballad or the bullet. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a cool piece, man. Yeah, well, one day I aspire to, you know, we have our own media company here in our community called Global Change Media. Founded by my father, Gabriel Urantia. And the idea is that we would put out films, and we're going to put out films that are uplifting, that are spiritual, that are communicating, but they're not going to be like the cheesy, you know, Christian films when you watch it and you're just like, what? They're going to be real because, you know, spiritual life, man, is a struggle and it's real. And sometimes it can be bloody. It can be whatever it is in people's lives that's going on.
Yeah.
It's not fluffy, you know.
Nope.
Loving God and serving God is not always fluffy. Most of the time, it's actually not.
Yeah.
I'd like to find out where it is fluffy and maybe go there, but I don't think it exists.
Yeah. If you find it, let me know.
Yeah, I will. We'll go together. We'll take a road trip, man.
Yeah, I love that.
Kick back in the fluffiness and just relax.
I heard that.
That's when Jesus comes back to the planet, maybe.
Right.
Things will get restored, you know?
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I really appreciate your time, man, and talking to you.
Brother.
One last question yeah. I had for you.
I could
talk to you all day, but
me too.
I'll probably have you on my podcast again in a few months. But
okay, all right. You let me know, brother. I'll be there.
You seem to be very well read, and you have a great understanding. And I really like how you bring a historic context into everything. Are there any books or literature or writers that you would recommend to our listeners to check out, to read, or for me personally, I'm interested.
Yeah, I think so many.
Howard Zinn, A People's History of the United States, I read that in high school, and I've continued to read it ever since, and it really has opened up a whole other understanding about the history of the United States and stuff.
Yeah, there's so many, man. I mean, I'm reading David Blight's masterful treatment of the life of Frederick Douglass right now, which is really powerful. Mm. So I definitely recommend that. If you're looking at the history of African American people in this country, I would say The Warmth of Other Suns is brilliant. It is about the migration of Black people to the North from the Deep South. Mm. During the years after Reconstruction and the violence visited upon the Black community by the Ku Klux Klan, lack of opportunity. So that's a brilliant book. Also recommend The New Jim Crow is brilliant as well by Michelle Alexander. That's a wonderful book. There's a fabulous book written by a friend of mine, Dr. Joy DeGruy, called post-traumatic slavery syndrome, which is also quite extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And these are historical books that I've been engaged with. If you're looking for great fiction, I mean, that the list can go on for days. I love Toni Morrison. I love Shakespeare. That's a broad range of things. But
yeah,
historical books, those are really good. The Half Has Never Been Told is another good one. Stamped from the Beginning is another powerful book. So those are a few that I definitely recommend. Yeah. Absolutely.
Thank you. Yeah. What about spiritual study?
Mm-hmm. Oh gosh. That's a long list, man. I mean, I tell you, when I was back in my days before I became a Baha'i, a book that was very influential for me was The Road Less Traveled.
Oh yeah.
By Scott Peck.
Yeah, Scott Peck. Great book, man.
Love that book. I love, amongst the Baha'i text, the Kitab-i Aghan, which is about the concept of progressive revelation, which talks about the different manifestations of God that have come through time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about the interconnectedness of religion and spirituality, which is a wonderful book. I love, there's so many. I love Bradshaw, which is not an inherently spiritual book, but I think it's a deep dive into human personality and understanding. Focus on the Family by Bradshaw. It's a great book.
Right.
Came out in the 90s.
That's a lot, man. You gave us a good list right there.
There's so many, but those are some good ones to kind of pick through. Really good.
Cool.
Yeah.
I'm feeling led to ask this too. Does the Baha'i faith have any prayers that you memorize or,
Oh, gosh.
Or
yeah.
Could you close out our session with a prayer or maybe even your own personal prayer if you want?
Sure. I mean, there's one that I'm thinking about. Let me see if I can remember how it goes. Oh, yeah. It's from Shoghi Effendi, one of the central figures of the faith. And it basically captures pretty much everything we've been talking about in our discussion today. And it says, they whose hearts have been warmed by the energizing influence of God's creative love, cherish his creatures for his sake and recognize in every human face a sign of his reflected glory.
Hmm. Yeah, brother. Thank you, man.
Love you, man.
I love you, brother.
Too. Love you, man. Love your spirit.
That's
brother.
A great way to end it there. Great prayer. I love your spirit, too. It's an honor to have you on my podcast. I appreciate you sharing your experience, your wisdom, your art, your creativity, your mind with myself and all the listeners, man. It was a good one. Really appreciate
it. Hey, man, thank you for doing for the work that you're doing, brother. It's important. And I just want to encourage you, man, to keep it going. And all you got to do is call, brother. I'll be present. All right?
Much love. Thank you.
You got it, man. We'll talk.
We'll
take care.
Touch,
all right,
man.
All right, man.
Take it
Peace.
Easy. Check out my website at getrealordietrying.com. Leave me a voicemail on anchor.fm/getrealordietrying. Rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or any of the platforms you listen on. Be sure to follow me on social media and share this podcast with your friends. Word of mouth is a great way to share the vibe. Get Real or Die Trying with Amadon DeLerba is a production of Global Change Media. And remember, pain is temporary, victory is eternal.